FBI, Madrid, Louisiana, and Penn State, and Morelia. I think it's about a couple of minutes after. Couple of minutes after 10. So, can we start now, Jorge?
Sure, let's start. Okay, so here we go then. Hello everyone first, and it's nice and strange to know that you are hearing me from far away. So here the title is Defective Theories for a Continuum Limit for Loop Quantum Gravity, and it's going to be with special emphasis in what happens to vacuum independence, because this is we introduce some extra structure, and the main motivation of the second part of the talk is to see what happens with this extra structure in the moment that we analyze the vacuum independence. Okay, and this works in collaboration with Elisa Manrique, and here's the outline of the talk. Now in the second page. Okay, first I'm going to say why I'm going to do what I do, what is my main motivation, and where I want to apply it. I'm going to see in this bunch of problems, in this setting, what problems are the main open problems that motivate what I'm going to do in the middle of the talk. And then I'm going to specify in the number two how is that we have a general research plan and what we have done and what are our objectives, and what I'm going to talk about today is going to be at the end of that second point. Then I'm going to talk about background independence at the end. Okay, in the next slide, just to start the motivation. First, what are the target theories? What do I want to apply this machinery to? And the target theories are loop quantized theories, any loop quantized theory. And now, it's not only gauge theories now. No? That even though they are the more important ones, we have developed for scalar fields and a bunch of other things that are now called polymer representations or loop quantized. So first is the most important one that we have in mind, but not in the short term, but more in the long term or in the medium term, is gravity, and it's really our main objective. But if we really want to study also other gauge theories, when they are coupled to gravity and when they are not coupled to gravity too, and then some will have a background and some will not have a background, and we have to apply our machinery to all of them. So we will also, we already did, apply some scalar fields. And there are also model theories in lower dimensional gravity or 2D Young Mills or some model of quantum mechanics. And in particular, in this talk, we're going to study the background independence, just trying to have a model of gravity without the dynamical constraint or the scalar constraint, and that's called the Ising-Kukac model. Okay, the next slide is going to be is the outline of the talk. Now I'm going to talk about the background independence of that one has in usual loop quantum gravity, loop quantization. So I put the independence in quotes because we obviously do use a background, and the background that we assume is a manifold, a 3D manifold. So we have really, we are thinking about just a manifold without a fixed metric. And when one want to be precise, we can say whether we are talking about the smooth category, the analytic category, or piecewise analytic, or piecewise linear, So there are many options in the small letters of the approach. One has to specify one wants to be precise. The other important thing is about background independence is that two quantum gravity has a great feature of being able to represent the diffeomorphism group. So it consults a Hilbert space and a representative of some group of sigma in between quotes, because again one has to qualify it this is C infinity or C omega or what. Also part of the quotation mark comes from that the diffeomorphism group is not like the one we know in the classical physics, because somehow has a discrete action in the Hilbert space. And by that I mean that if you have a state and you move it slightly with the diffeomorphism, it really becomes orthogonal to the original state. So there are no generators in this diffeomorphism group. So it's a discrete group when it acts on H sigma. So the important thing of this diffeomorphism in gravity is that they are gauged. So one really has to mod out by this transformation. And loop quantum gravity has found a way to do that with the Rupert-Dragging technique, that is kind of a sum of error orbit implementation. And this is remarkable for this, that really needs some kind of renormalization, because the volume of the deep orbit is infinite. I like to know, since I've not seen almost any faces on out there, are you still hearing correctly?
Yes.
Yes. And I please, if you have any questions, feel free to interrupt in the middle. Soon it's going to end this introductory part, and then it will be very important that I have feedback, because not that I don't know if you are understanding. Okay, go to the next slide.
Jose Antonio, it's,
yes?
Whenever you have any slide, please explain every symbol on the slide. That is
okay. Okay. Now I'm in. I was in the slide that said background independence, and in that the only symbols that they have to be explained was that the. I call the Hilbert space of the loop quantum gravity H sigma, and I'm going to be going back and forth from H to the state of cylindrical functions. I'm going to explain a little bit more about that when I come out of the motivation. But so these are two vector spaces where we represent things, and they are slightly different. One is the completion of the other one. And when I mention here HD, it's just the state of solutions of the ones that are the states that are diffeomorphism invariant. And it's going to be important to say things about this equation there, or that I wrote, this mathematical expression. But I'm going to explain it later on. So now I have come out of this slide, two slides over, where it says open problem. Okay? I'm in the slide with title open problem. And the open problem here, dynamics comes as the major open problem, not that it has not been studied and completely finished in one particular way by Zeeman, but still there are questions about the physical correctness of that implementation. So in particular, I want to mention not about the particular Zeeman strategy, but about a feature of quantum gravity and why it's so difficult to treat the problem of the dynamics, and that is because the point splitting regularization that we use many times doesn't do its job as it does in other field theories. Here, when because of that, the feature that we are working with loops that are one-dimensional objects, and as soon as we move in slightly, they become orthogonal states, things that intuitively will converge, they don't. Here, so after we do some regularization, we have an expression as a limit when some little loop shrinks to being just a point, all these expressions don't converge on H sigma because of that discrete character that it has. And so other open problem that I'm going to that is important for my motivation is that everyone is now trying to study the semi-classical limit or macroscopic limit, Newtonian limit, or somehow see how is that the standard low energy physics can come out of this kind of quantum field theory that we work on. And these two points are really separate, that major open big problems that motivate what I'm going to do. So I'll invent another smaller problem motivated by these two big ones. And now go to the next slide. I'm going to say the research plan. And so the transparency is called, it has a title called Structures Developed. So what we have done in the research plan is that we already developed some structures that they are really an implementation of Gilson's renormalization group. And we say that it's tailored to loop quantization. So first, we developed we proposed a notion of measuring scale. And by that, I mean that when one is in a real situation in a hypothetical lab, one only has finitely many or discretely many things that one can measure. And we say that these things are going to be the important scale, a measurement scale. I'm going to talk on that with care later. And once we have specified this notion of measurement scale, we develop an effective theory tailored to that scale, and we also include a regularization that is we can write in that effective theory expression that and we already have several effective theories, one at each scale. We are interested to see their relation, and the relation comes from a force training map that is really a estimation that we haven't explained later. Once we know all the scales at which people could measure things and their relation, then what we want to do is to talk about a big meta theory that is the continuum theory, what we are going to call the continuum theory. That is one theory such that with the knowledge of that theory, you could project to the effective theory. That is, if you know all the microscopic details, you should be able to explain physics at any given scale. And so that theory that can give you the information for all the theories at any given scale, that's going to be called the continuum. And we are going to talk about observables there and how we construct them by renormalization. Okay, so the next slide is now they call the overall picture. Okay? Go to the slide with title overall picture. So first, what is the objective? What we want to apply these quantum field theories and these techniques for? And we want to apply it to all the quantum this theory is defined over metric background paired to set the method. I mean, Sally said at the beginning that we want to implement a way to do quantum field theories for manifolds that don't necessarily have a background metric. That doesn't mean that they cannot have one. It's important to apply it to manifolds with a metric, so we can test with other quantum field theories and quantum quantization techniques that are developed and they are well established and they compare to nature correctly. So we should apply our good to this kind of theory. And then also we want to start exploring quantum field theories in the absence of a background metric. And obviously our main goal is gravity coupled to mass, but that's going to wait a little bit. So we are going to reconsider simple models that have already been developed by loop quantum loop quantization techniques. And we are going to see what our structures can say about this implementation of Wilson renormalization. So now I'm going to change slide to explain what today's question. So go to the slide that says today's question. Today's question is going to be to study what happens with the background independence after I give the structure that is going to be necessary to specify what's a measuring scale. To specify a measuring scale, I'm going to add some extra structure to the manifold that was not there, and then what happens with the background independence after I put this background. Am I going to be able to take that structure away or take a continuum limit properly, or am I going to be left with some residues of that? And the question is very much in analogy with the one that is field theory people ask when they are studying a Euclidean field theory with the rotational symmetry, for example. So they know that there is not a lattice in intrinsic to the nature of the system they are studying, and they want to know if when they finish their study, if they are going to have a theory, a quantum field theory that is rotationally symmetric or not. And remember that there is a difference because in gravity we don't really have a diffeo symmetry but diffeo gauge. But anyway, the question is in some sense similar. So that's going to be the main focus of the last part of the talk, and just we have to keep it in mind for some minutes now. Transparency is already starting with the explanation of the structure that we have developed. So go to the next slide with blue title is measuring scale. But what I'm going to be talking on for now, this middle part of the talk, is about the structures that we developed and how is that we implemented this Wilson renormalization in a way compatible with loop quantization. So we start now with the space of cylindrical functions. And I think most people know what they are, but they are functions on the connection. In this case, we are going to be talking about gravity. So we have a manifold, sigma, in which there is a connection, an SU2 connection, to be precise. And so one can consider holonomies along loops. So a way to construct functions on this state of connection is to have some loops drawn on the manifold and then measure their holonomies that are gauge invariant things that take the trace of the holonomy and then that's an invariant. And one can consider then a function of that trace of the holonomy, and that's what I call phi, for example. Yeah? And And so there are many cylindrical functions on the manifold that one can consider like that. We are just putting loops or also putting some labeled gaps with colors that are called P networks. And when I put this J or K, that's what I have in mind, some P networks. And so it's a graph that has some coloring, and that's the label that specifies what cylindrical function I'm talking about. That's also a function of the connection, but depends on the connection in a very particular way. It doesn't depend on the connection anywhere outside of the drawn graph. Okay, so here is the big, the main point of the talk. If you don't understand what this measuring scale, you are not going to understand the rest of the talk. What we do now is to say that the one is trying to measure the cylindrical function, but to decide in what state the field is. And then it's not a complete measurement, can only measure partially things. And what we are going to do is to imagine that the measuring device is really a cellular decomposition of the manifold. In particular, say today, I'm going to just do very simple, concrete things. And what I'm going to do is to put an initial triangulation of the manifold that I call delta. And that's the delta I'm going to subdivide by this subdivision many times. And put an n, that the scale is going to be specified by n. What I mean is how many times I've done by eccentric subdivision on the triangulation delta. So here in the picture, I have a manifold with a triangulation delta that I have subdivided once. So this is for n equal to 1. And then that's where my effective theory is going to happen, in that manifold with a triangulation that is the SD1. Okay? And there are many cylindrical functions that are identified. Here is the picture. It presents two different loops labeled with the same color, J equal to 1/2. Yes? And for the purposes of the effective theory, they are going to be indistinguishable. And I'm going to explain it a little more in the next slide. So this is the spirit of the talk. The measuring scale is going to be given by this subdivision of the manifold as a triangulation that is going to make the theory combinatorial in a way. Okay, so next slide.
Are you explaining to us the map?
Jose Antonio? There was a map.
Yes.
In the last...
The map is going to be the subject of the next three slides.
Okay.
The map is coming. So we are now in the slide entitled Effective Theories and Regularization. So first it says what the main structure of the loop quantization is, this state of generalized connection. And if you to think about it, with one base point that I call a star, and that state A mod G with the star is really the state of homomorphisms from the group of loops based on that star point to the group SU2. And it's important to know that the group of loops is only modulo retracing, so thin loops don't matter. Okay, so we have that group and SU2 and the group homomorphisms from there are really our connections modulo gauge. And then here comes the origin of that map. What I'm going to do is that the group of loops, I'm going to make a map from that group to a small group called Pn of the scale n. And what it does is that from a loop, it assigns to it a sequence of cells in which it was. So, for example, if the loop starts in the in the triangle alpha 1, the first cell is alpha 1, and then it passes through the boundary between two triangles, and then it's alpha 2, and then goes to the next triangle, alpha 3, and like that, until it's at the end closes. Okay, so alpha n is the same as alpha 1. And that's the mapping. And it is obvious that there are many different loops that go to the same, it's a many to one map. Okay, so I'm dividing loops into equivalence classes. So Pn is the elements of Pn are equivalence classes of loops. In that same map, but now going in reverse, is the one that is going to give generalized connections, modulo gauge, from our connections at the modulo gauge at level n. And what is that? So at scale n, we again consider the group homomorphisms from Pn to SU2, and that's by definition the MOG n. And we can assign to it generalized connections, and what are they? They are simply connections that assign the same polynomy to loops that are in the same equivalence class. Okay? And now we go to the next slide, and I'm going to be a little faster because I'm going to slow it. So now it goes to the cylindrical functions. So here we have to dualize again after I explained the nature of the mapping on connections. Now the functions of connections go again in the direction from till sigma now to till n, and they come from that map that they explained already. And so that's really the double dual kind of this equivalent class map. Yes, and I'm not going to try to draw these two stars all the time. I'm just going to drop them from now on. That's what I'm going to do. So this map is very important to realize that it can be thought as a map from state to state, or better, from observables to observables. Yes, so it comes from the continuum, and it regularizes the observables, the cylindrical observables, to scale n. And there we are going to then work on scale n, and we are going to do quantization at scale n, very much in the spirit of group quantization, but just now, this scale n is very much like the space of functions on a lattice. Okay.
Can you tell us what is the structure on the space of connections A mod G at the scale n? Is this
you get a lattice that you get from you have a manifold, you make a triangulation, and there the triangulation that of scale n, there you can make a lattice gate theory associated to that triangulation, and really something that's a little bit finer. And it's just the lattice gate theory of that lattice. What it means is that A mod Gn can give you the polynomy on any loop if you bring the connections to the continuum by the map it might give you, but also should be thought just as a lattice gauge theory.
Is the lattice gauge theory based on the dual lattice of the triangulation, or is a dual graph of the triangulation?
On the dual lattice, no, it's not really the dual lattice. If you want to be precise, you have to get the triangulation that is called SGN of delta, and of that, you have to do again a bisecting subdivision to see what is that thing. So it will be SGN into the n plus 1, and there in that thing, you just see the lines and vertices, the lattice gate theory there tells you all the information about the connections A mod N. Because in this A mod N, we have vertices that are the cells of the triangulation A D N. So for each cell, we have a vertex, if you want, like that. Anyway, let me go on a little faster because I see that I'm not going to arrive to the end that I want to. So here, basically, the message is that it's one lattice gate theory associated to the triangulation of scale n. Okay, now the same thing goes for the cylindrical function. And so what happens with the cylindrical functions at scale in the continuum that go to n? They just go many cylindrical functions to the same interval, many to one map. That depends on if I get a spin network, how does this spin network intersect the triangulation SDN? Okay? And if there are two that have the same intersection type, there is J and K that intersect the lattice in the same way, then we have two different cylindrical functions that go to the same cylindrical function at scale n. Okay, now we go to the slide called effective theories and regularization. And I have here a triangle diagram. It's important to note that then I'm going to have these maps, equivalent class. So if I have two different scales, m and n, and n is finer, that symbol means that n is bigger, means finer, has more triangles. Then the map equivalent class of this bracket, so nm, regularizes from scale n to m. And basically, it's based in that the triangle diagram that is below commutes. Okay, so I can regularize in different ways and obtain the same thing. The second point here is that I can, if I vary the scale and I can get it as fine as I want, I can distinguish and separate different states. So if I have two different states, phi j and phi k, then they are going to have eventually a different regularization. Okay, so if that's clear, go to the next case, to the next slide. And basically, what we are saying is that at one scale, we don't have all the information. But if we have information of all the scales, we will be able to recover everything that is said in the continuum. So the information that we have in the continuum is stored in the information at all the possible given scales. But if one stays in a single one meets a lot. I mean in the slide called approximation of functional in the continuum. So now, just to explain this thing with an example, imagine that you are in the continuum and you have a Hamiltonian, and you want to take the expectation value of that Hamiltonian in a given state. So that functional that I call we call little h of phi, I can approximate it using a functional of that type at scale n. And the way to do it is following the diagram. So first I have the state I want to calculate the expectation value on, and I take it to space to sigma, to scale sigma, and then I calculate the so. The main point now is that if I have several of these functions hn, I can compare them as what they will do on states in the continuum. And so it may be that I can produce a sequence of these hn that converges. I think it's important to realize that this is completely different from the case where one thinks to converge as one takes a limit and one takes the limit of suggested by the pond splitting procedure used in loop quantum gravity sometimes just as a motivation. But there the limit never works, this H sigma or in P sigma, the limit that one that is suggested by loop by point splitting that doesn't converge. But these other limits, they do converge many times. Okay, now I go to the next slide.
But what is the assumption on the Hamiltonian for this procedure to work?
There are conditions. Sometimes it doesn't converge, sometimes it converges. Now it's just the preliminary thing about the limit that can exist. Later I'm going to give a complete procedure that suggests taking some limits, and there is a code that these kind of limits are of the type that converge. But now basically what I'm saying is that since I'm not working here in Seal, but if you see I'm working on the convergence that I'm talking about happens in Seal. I'm talking about functionals on Seal sigma. And what I'm saying is these things have a much better chance of converging.
My question
they
is...
The things that appear naturally in what I'm going to say later.
My question is just what is capital H sub n?
What is happening? What? H sub n?
Yes.
N. Capital. I'm giving you a procedure to do something, but I could, for example, regularize that have a Hamiltonian in the classical theory, in the continuum, and regularize it to scale n and produce this functional Hn just like that.
Okay, so...
At any n.
Okay.
And what I'm saying is that how can I compare different effective theories with different n, and there is going to be one way called for draining that I'm going to tell you later, but I can also compare them as what they do to the continuum, because I introduce these effective theories as kind of equivalent classes of theories that are appropriate to when you measure the continuum with a given sensitivity. So this is a natural question. And really what is going to happen many times is that to get convergence of things, one has to adjust some parameters. So I'm going to talk about that in two slides. Okay, so next comes the important ingredient called force draining and a destination map that I'm going to introduce. So, this map goes in the opposite direction as the map that I had before that I called regularization. This one is called the Cortini map. So I'm supposed to assign a state in the continuum in Seal sigma from a state in Seal n. And the way to do it is simplified in the figure. The way to picture the spin networks of Seal n is again, graphs labeled by color, but now the graphs are should be thought as made of cells of the triangulation, that is triangles. And here I just drew with the red the dimension 2 triangles, but there should also be some dimension 1 and dimension 0 possible there, but I omitted them for simplicity. And so this loop that I put here in the screen, it should be mapped to the continuum, and I have to decide where to put it. It's like when one is a kid in the newspaper and they tell you to join the dots that are there, you have to produce a loop, and you choose a way to do it, okay? So here, it depends on a choice. But the choice that we are going to do in this talk is the cost on the bicentric subdivision, so it's going to be the bicentric embedding. So each dot, I put it in the bicentric of the bicenter of the corresponding triangle, and then I join them with a line according to the triangle. So the triangle itself knows what are straight lines, and there that's what I want to use. So in this talk, we are choosing to have our Kozgany map done by this barycentric embedding. Okay. Now, what are the properties of the map? The one important property is this triangle diagram of this sort for you. The other thing is that it is consistent with the regularization map, very much in the way that it happens in fiber bundles.
Are you bringing in a background metric now?
What?
Are you using a background metric in order to do this embedding?
The thing that I'm using is that at each scale, I have a triangulation there, and I'm using that triangulation as a way to put the more than the background, it's a Euclidean structure in pieces. So, yes, I'm introducing a lot of background, and that's why there is the interest of the question that I'm going to address later, what happens with all these structures that I'm putting, because it really a lot of new things that were not in the manifold before.
Okay, but for the first map, the triangulation was only a topological triangulation. But now it seems to me that you are using additional metric.
Yes, you are correct. The first map, it just regularizes the manifold as an combinatorial simplicial complex. And that doesn't introduce a background metric. It does introduce a background in the sense that I could have shoved the manifold in different ways. But now, for the coarse graining, I need a map that goes in this, with the arrow in this direction. And so what I have to do is to choose embedding. And the choice of embedding is huge, and it's always going to be introducing a background, because someone else could have introduced a different coarse graining map. And what I'm choosing to do this time is just to, maybe an overkill, but just choose one that is tailored to the simplicial complex. And a way to do it is that the simplicial complex can be realized as an Euclidean in pieces, pieces of R to the end with the Euclidean metric, and then that's what I'm doing this time. But this choice.
Okay.
Okay, now I'm going to talk about what happens to observables when I use cold graining. And what happens is that first I regularize, let's say that here M is a scale that is lower resolution than N. N is finer than M. So I regularize my theory at scale M, and then I produce this, in this example, again an H, some Hamiltonian that I'm going to compute the expectation value later. And so I have that regularization at scale M, and also I have it at a finer scale N. And the coarse graining map is going to allow me to bring the information from the more microscopic scale to scale M. So what I do is I follow this triangle diagram, and what I produce is another theory for another function that has to do with the Hamiltonian at scale M, but that knows about some finer detail scale M. Of course, these two theories cannot be completely independent, because they are supposed to describe the same phenomenon. And what people do actually is that the two of them have some tunable parameter, and both of them have been tuned using the same. So HM and HN already agree by construction on a few things that they predict. And the question of whether one is correct in HM is in the other one. So one produces an effective theory HM by tuning a few parameters, and the rest of the things that one measures is prediction, Here, when we introduce the corrections from HN, it is going to correct only that new predictions, and it's going to agree on the things that were already pre-seeded. So that's why we say that this constraint of the observable HN includes microscopic corrections to HN. And next slide. And now what's up with the continuum? The continuum, what was that? So at scale M, we can study the convergence of the microscopic. So I'm still not asking questions about the continuum as what happens to scale sigma. But I want to still be in the lab at scale M, and I want to have my best tool to do predictions. And so what I want to do is to, I know now how to incorporate microscopic corrections, and I want to do that with finer and finer scale. So I take this limit, and when n goes to infinity, and if it converges, that means that I'm reaching an optimal theory at scale m. So it's the best theory possible at scale m. And that's what convergence means. Okay, now the next slide, field observables in the continuum. Imagine that I have this optimal observable, the collection HM REN. REN is of renormalized. What happens when, can I use them again to correct the theory that defined is at scale n? Can I use now a better correction from scale n and correct again? And the question, the answer is that no, they are all compatible. They agree in the sense of that formula that I have down here, that the constraint of a finer one is the coarser one, when they are already renormalized. And so this collection already knows about all the possible experimental settings of the class that I'm talking about. So in that sense, it's already the continuum, that collection of compatible renormalized theories. So in that sense, the continuum can be expressed mathematically in the equation or diagram that is at the bottom of the transparency. And what is the continuum then in this setting is this direct limit of scale n. And that means that the states that belong to that space, the states that are cylindrical at some scale n. So this collection of Hamiltonians can produce the expectation value in a given state. This class of states are states that belong to this direct limit. This is a limit that has a right pointing arrow. That one is called the direct limit, and the states of there are the appropriate states on which the collection of compatible collection of Hamiltonians can act. And I here have a comment that this space naturally can be injected into field sigma, but in fact it is only a little piece of field sigma. For example, it's separable. This is a very small piece of field sigma. What would happen? Can I somehow get the continuum to tell me things about field sigma? And why do I care about field sigma? Well, because I'm in the loop community here. Other people may not care about it. This already the other space, it is a space in the continuum. But this, for example, for geometries or something, is not as nice as field sigma. So next slide, please. Here I have another way to talk about observables in field sigma that is using the regularization map that I talked about before. So I have a state in field sigma, I put it into field n, and I wait until you are in the correct transparency, I don't know. It's called observables in the continuum, and it has this triangle client here. So from T sigma to T len, and then from T len to T, you'll see this HN renormalized. And the question is whether these things are going to converge when n goes to infinity. And they do. They do for if the renormalization, the normalized map exists, this diagram usually produces limits that exist. So I can use also this convergence. It's not a theory that it's always when the renormalized observables exist, this other limit always exists, but many times it exists and depends, and it is because usually one ends up with continuous mapping, but the H there's a sort of continuity there, but this is not a theorem that these things always come to converge. It many times converges, and it is a sign of you have a theory that is not too wide. Okay, next transparency is called I'm going back now. Going forward to the last section that is called the study of background independence. Okay, now, so now is the main. With the previous transparency, I finished saying about the general framework that we introduced, and now I'm going to study what happens with background independence, given that I put all this extra stuff in the manifold. Okay, so I got to review what happened in loop quantum gravity proper, or standard, okay? And what happens with the diffeomorphism invariant, diffeomorphism constraint, okay? The looking for solutions to that is in states that are invariant on their diffeos, and they don't belong to C sigma, but they belong to the dual. And there is a nice way to construct them called by a rigging map or so-called rigging map. And what it does is that it takes a clinical function and produces from it, using it as a sieve, and taking it with a, moving it all around with the diffeo group, it produces with this orbit some state in some functional on sigma, and this produced the idea of how it is done. It is in this equation with between quotes, and that's the question. Equation can be properly written, but I'm not going to do it today. It takes some time. So this is the basic idea of the group averaging technique applied to diffeos. Okay, it is worthy to mention that these sums are huge. They are very infinite in a way. So when we have two different cylindrical functions that cannot be matched by any x. So for example, if their graphs are not diffeomorphic, then this thing will be zero all the time. But when they are not, when they are in the same class, then the sum here is infinite, uncostably infinite. So one has to do some proper dividing by infinity or something like that. Next slide. So since the core of that are diffeomorphisms, then what happens to diffeomorphisms at scale n? Or m, that's a question that if we know that our classical theory has this important symmetry or invariant, and we would want to write an effective theory at a given scale, then the first question is what happens to the symmetry that I have after I quantize it in this scale, what happens? And I think what happens is that it's broken, but when I get all of the different scales, I can somehow recover it. So look at the diagram below. If I have a diffeomorphism F from sigma to sigma, that thing induces maps that I call Fn in at each scale. Okay? And what But it's important to know this is that this collection of observables Fn is compatible in the sense that if I have the Fn and I forget about the original F on T sigma, I can, if I have only Fn, I can from it reconstruct already Fm and all the ones, all the mapping F from coarser scales than M or N. So it is, they are compatible. From one single F, I generate a sequence, a collection of compatible maps. Another important thing is that these sets that I'm going to call this N, they are all finite. So that sum that I pointed out that they could be infinite, that in the continuum, at scale N is definitely not infinite because these sets, I don't call them groups because they are not natural groups. They are finite sets. And another important property is that if I have two different diffeos in the continuum F and G, then they are going to be differentiated eventually by at scale n. Here I wrote it as f equal to g if and only if fn equals to gn for all n. So in a sense I can recover the information in the continuum from the information in all the scales as I told you before. And next slide. What I can say, even though I recover all the information from the diffeos, there are many inconveniences of thinking about giving a scale for different autism purposes. And so here is a list of them. At any given scale, we do not have a representation of this, because one could have thought that okay, you have this smaller space now till n, maybe there is a repetitive sigma there, but that is not faithful or something. Maybe there is a subgroup group of this sigma that can be represented there or something. But in general, there is no such structure. So the next point is that even when in this space that I said that quantum study the continuum limit, even there, isomorphisms do not act in a proper way. Because as I put it, it's a particular subset of still sigma, and that set will not be left invariant by most details. So since it depends on all the choices that I took, if I move with a diffeo, I move my choices, this background metric that I was talking about, I move it and I arrive to some different state. So that space in the continuum is not good for talking about diffeos. So there is a representation that one can take in another space of the continuum constructed with a little sigma, still n, but this is this other one. It's really a projective, constructed with a projective limit of not the map, Kolmogenic map, but the regularization map. And this one is very big. In fact, one can naturally put two sigma inside of it. And there, yes, you can represent the diffeomorphisms. So if you eventually want to talk about diffeomorphism somehow in this setting, you should do it in this limit, although it's not as nice as this sigma by any means. Okay, then the next thing to say is that if I want to study the regularization and then renormalization of this, I guess that there are finite sums of the sum averaging, of the diffeo group averaging was regularized, then I encounter several obstacles. And one is that the number of coupling constants, that things that one would call coupling constants, is enclosed in the sum, they grow at n goes to infinity. And that never happens for a theory that has a chance of being renormalizable. No? And so here, what I call the coupling constant is that in the sum, I can put this beta here that depends on the state that I have at scale n. And one could say, okay, why don't you just put them all to one or something like that, but that's not consistent in it's easy to see why not. Because here I'm summing over the set this n, and this set, again, this sum many times is going to be just adding zeros. So sometimes it's not adding zeros, and it's going to, the number of times that one can have non-zero contribution depends very much on the nature of the discretization or the regularization. So it is rather difficult. And one would have to compensate with this coupling constant, and this is a very difficult combinatorial problem that one would have to solve. Obviously, it's not a solution, because, for example, we could take the solution that's already known from Q sigma and pull it back. But anyway, that's not the purpose of doing this. The next thing in common that I put in this slide is that since the symmetry does not help when one restricts to a given scale, so let's say I want to talk about scale m, then should I encounter, or if I want to look for a nice effective theory there, usually it's done with certain level of accuracy on a truncation cost. And so it has to be something that looks nice. It has few tunable parameters. But what can I choose is usually on the support of symmetries. And here I don't have any symmetries that tell me that leave at scale n. And that's a big problem. And if now I go back to this motivation that I had originally, that is to study what happens to background independence here as an analogy to what happens with rotational invariance in Euclidean quantum field theory with the lattice. This one is the only difference, not the previous point. The Euclidean quantum field theory in the lattice, it can be done, and it's done only when you can have these useful truncations that come because there are symmetries, there's some group of the translation group or something that lets you have only a few coupling constants, and then you see what happens with what's left. No, but you're going to start with few coupling constants, and here this symmetry is gone, so it's not very useful in the stage that it is. Okay, so now I go to now say some positive things in the, but this story of the negative things are just the ones that are going to tell you think about one way to improve this strategy if you want to, because, I mean, you may not even want to continue in this particular line or study with this line background independent problems or diffeomorphism group averaging. Okay? So now the summary is the next slide. And this is what we have done is with a single framework, that is this group quantum gravity plus some implementation of the Wilson renormalization group ideas. We have treated quantum field theories on metric and non-metric backgrounds. Okay, And the next thing is we have we can compare with the standard treatment and there is one alternative treatment and there is complete agreement. For example, we have done the 2D model, we have studied polymer quantum mechanics, we have done this polymer quantum mechanics and some Polici talked about it some days ago. And it is a model theory that is not really quantum mechanics at the beginning, but then if you move that it is closer with these tools, then it is. And then there is 2D Young Mills that is also suitable by this model, by this way, and is compatible with previous treatments. And there is TQFTs. And also now we did the H10-Kukesh model with difficulty at the end. And in fact, there are some other things that I'm not mentioning here that also one can learn of the successes and the difficult things. So for example, in TQFTs, also there are things that are very nice to say about this. These things, and when there is agreement, but one has to do particular things to reach agreement, and one can really renormalize and right. So now, another point here is that the source of the difficulty in this problem of today came from the good relation between the non-locality of not classes, that, and our notion of measuring scale. So, in one sense, you have the triangles that were fixed in the lattice, and this was in one place there. And on the other hand, you have not classes that do not live in a particular space of the lattice, and they didn't seem to interact very well together. And I say here that in a different variant, the quantum field theory that doesn't see all the different not classes. For example, some invariant that may identify many not classes, but that could be calculated locally. So that seems to be much nicer with our peak triangulation on the manifold. So anything that could be calculated locally is going to be not have this problem that we have of the treating with the not classes that were not localized in the manifold. In particular, if the theory that one has to deal with has something like different variants or even more, but that is local, then I see a much better, a much more promising future for that thing, because, for example, we can also doing our have a scale that they are refined locally. We can, in this day, I could, for you, I gave you the explanation only with scale n, so I had the scale labeled by the integer. But really, what I mean from the set of scales is only a partial ordering, and I can then refine in some places and not in others, and they don't all have to be triangles. I mean, so this framework is much more flexible. And still we have the same problem with the not classes. That's why today I just presented that and not the whole flexible framework to simplify the difficulties, because that was the point of today. And but in another quantum theory that is interested only in calculating some things that are local, then I think we are going to have much better chance for that, for this time. And now to the last slide, the acknowledgement. So this work was done with Elisa, and we both acknowledge discussions with the people that are here below, Raimundo Bautista, Corici, Homero Diaz, Jorge Martinez, Claudio Menezes, Robert Ojo, Tania Bucasina, and Axel Weber, and other people that I mentioned. Bye-bye, that's it. Questions, please.
seems to me, is it possible to switch off your microphone?
My microphone? Yes, let me see.
Okay, yeah, that's good. No echo now. So it seems to me that kind of the most useful application of effective theories in the framework of background independence and so on that we do in loop quantum gravity would be really to do something the other way around. Namely, you really want to start with some candidate theory and coarse grain and see what effective theories you get. The way you are doing it is really trying to define the theory via successive effective theories and quote-unquote looking at the renormalization group. But as you pointed out, at some stage in the construction, you are actually using, in the coarse graining procedure, you're using all kinds of background structures, and then you do not know if the results are going to be, you know, invariant and under the choice of changes of these background structures. So it seems to me that a much more powerful application of this framework would be to do the other way around, namely consider some semi-classical states, in which case the semi-classical state might give you the background structure, and then use your technology to really coarse grain and get some effective theories with which you can then compare with experiments and so on. In particular, things like is the Lorentz invariance violated in the effective theories and so on. Have you thought about such inverse application of your formalism?
Yes, I thought about it, but not very deeply. I mean, that was the original motivation of doing this, to look for the macroscopic limit. In fact, that's how we started. But then, I got interested in this other aspect of in going to the continuum that I think is very rich, but the other aspect is also very interesting to me. And I have only some initial things, and I want to work on that too. But anyway, there is not much done.
Okay, I have one more question, if you could switch off your microphone. Okay, so
yes.
Actually, maybe I should ask a couple of questions and then you can speak so we don't have to switch off the microphone. I mean, in your last but one transparencies, which began with however, you point out this story about the coupling constants, basically, and then you say that the coupling constants are constrained by a diffeomorphism invariant, but there is a complicated combinatorial equation to solve. My question really here is that does one even know that the solution exists or is it unique, forgetting about actually obtaining it? So this is my first question. My second question was really the level where we, early on, when you define kind of Hamiltonians, H sub n, at some scale n of discretization. The question really is that is there any relation between, for example, those Hamiltonians, supposing I want you to do it in loop quantum gravity, so is there any relation between those Hamiltonians and the continuum Hamiltonian, or the what you would call continuum Hamiltonian, that is obtained by, for example, Thiemann-like procedure or algebraic quantum field theory programs of Thiemann, etc., etc.? The last question is really that at many stages you said this procedure always works, but the question is really whether it works in cases which are not just topological field theories. Okay, these are the three questions.
My memory is very bad, so I start with the last one, and then try to recover the other question. And I think that what Thomas did when he produced his Hamiltonian was to somehow start with a regularization given a triangulation, no? And then work on that. So here the first step is already the same. Here he produced his first thing that is really a Hamiltonian that is completely ambiguous or dry. and see what happens. So what happens in how Thomas solves his problem is that he says that the Hamiltonian doesn't act on the kinematic activity space, but only on the deep environment in the space of HP, the solution to the DTO. So we could do the same. We could do the same there. And here we would have the question would be whether we are gaining anything. And the natural thing to study in our framework would be to, now that we have the polarization of the top at each scale, what happens when you constrain? I cannot study the problem in detail, but it doesn't look like something terribly bad is going to happen. But to have agreement, there's going to have to be some tunable parameter somewhere. And here, that's the issue. What are you going to do with that, these regularizations that don't obviously have a tunable parameter? But one could try to work on those lines. In fact, we are not on that problem, but some much simpler problem related to what happens when you work with trying to define observables depending on the curvature. That is really what happens. Also, you have an expression, classical expression that depends on the curvature, and you regularize it, and depends on colonomies, and so what do you have? And that's an interesting thing to study, I think. And I think there is a relation to what those people have to study. I have not this work, but I'm doing work on there with my student Romero. Other questions, I remember the first question that you said, that was about whether there are solutions to these combinatorial restrictions on the coupling constant. And what I want to point out is that once there is as you said, once you have this theory in the continuum, I can constrain it to any scale. So since the group averaging formula exists in Cd sigma, I can constrain it to it. And by construction, then they are compatible, that already we normalized. In a sense, that's the solution. The thing is whether it looks at any scale like an effective theory, and no, it doesn't, because it's already a renormalized theory. So that's the answer seems to be that there is no simple thing at any scale, but there is a complicated formula at any scale that is the cross grain of the deep averaging formula there. So, and it is pretty obvious what to do. You take your state at the stage till n, and you put them in the continuum in till sigma using the cross-grain map, and there you act with the group averaging formula and see what happens. So it tells you whether there is something different different from zero, and if they are not isomorphic, then it's going to be zero. But data within the framework, this slightly richer answer that says that since I showed you that, I didn't really show you in detail, but I told you that there was a secret space that they could be constructed from this space Cn as a projected limit using the regularization map. Anyway, in that space, the action of visual component of visual. And there, one could do the same thing that people do in loop quantization in still sigma there, but I don't see any novelty in that, just that the possibility is there. So you can talk about visual in that place. And it's exactly that place where we could talk about rotational symmetry in latter-case theory in the continuum limit when you are studying some implicit theory that needs it. But in that analogy, work in that space where we could have to work the diffeosymmetry too. So it exists and is there, but as far as regularization or simple effective theory at scale m or n, there is no such a thing. Okay, now I go to the second question. Could you remind me the second question?
No, it's okay. I think we're running out of time. So let us ask if there are other people who have questions. Okay, Jorge, any announcements?
No.
So let us thank Jose Antonio again because we are running out of time for the bridge.
Okay, bye-bye.